Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Demetria.
Thank you. My name is Demetria, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I was thinking, that's my first problem. It's National Siblings Day, and I didn't realize that until Debbie and I were driving over here. Debbie, she's the main speaker. She's my sister. And my brother Paul is here. I mean, you guys have no idea how miraculous that is. You just don't have any idea whatsoever. So I'm really grateful to be sober. I'm really, really grateful to be sober. And I'm really grateful to be here tonight. And I know that God isn't going to let me mess this up too bad. Because if he was, you know, I'd probably be dead. I was on the road of really just, you know, totally mass self-destruction when I was out there drinking and using. And I told myself that I wasn't going to get nervous, and of course I am, and I don't know why, because you guys are like me, you're drunks, you know, we're just drunks, and if you're anything like me, you've really done some things that you wouldn't want to stand up in front of a group of people and say, you know, so I just feel like I'm really nervous, and I'm going to get that out there and say that, you know. It's funny because I used to be a singer. I used to get on stage in front of people every night, and I did it for 12 years, and I never got stage fright. I just bellied up to the bar and had a couple of drinks first and got on stage, and everything was fine. And because of that, that sort of escalated my alcoholism, because I was drinking every night. At a young age, I was 19 when I started drinking every night, because that's when I started working in bars. And of course, it didn't take long to get into drugs, and that, of course, just exacerbated my downhill slide. And it's just amazing how things happen. I don't think that I probably would not have. I keep popping my peas, and I'm aware of it, so I apologize, but it's bothering me. So I probably wouldn't have got here had it not been for my sister Debbie. She got sober first, and you know, I mean, when she got sober, I was like, I was just turning 20, 21, you know, so she would try and talk to me about all the stuff that she was learning in AA, and it was all so good, and I was like, oh my God, I mean, that sounds terrible, I'm sorry, but, you know, I don't want to hear it. I do not want to hear it, and I didn't want to hear it. I just was not interested. And she took me to my first AA meeting. I think it was New Year's Eve. And first of all, she took me to a dance at Pine. You know, and I got to watch her have a great time, you know. And I'm like going, oh, my God. I had just turned 21. And I'm going, oh, my God, what am I doing here? This sucks, you know. So anyway, and then we went to a meeting. And I think it was at the Alano Club over Charlie's Shoe Shop. So that was how long ago I got in here. Not too terribly long after that, when I was 25, I was working again at a nightclub up in Modesto, and I had, you know, I was really heavily into cocaine, and I was drinking every night. I mean, they counted the shots of cinnamon schnapps that I drank one night, and it was 13, and they couldn't believe it, because you couldn't tell. You know, they're like, wow, you could really hold your liquor. I was like, well, yeah, you know, when you're, I don't know, that was how I did things. I never did anything that was middle of the road. I never wanted to control and enjoy my drinking. If I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. And if I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. And I had no issues whatsoever about wanting to control my drinking. I didn't control myself. And I guess that kind of started when I was 15 and my father passed away. And Debbie and Paul were gone from the home. They had their own families. They lived their own lives. And it was just me and my mom living at my house. And my mom was a great, we grew up in an alcoholic family. And so my mom was a great codependent. And she just let me be my own boss. So I started cutting school all the time and doing exactly what I wanted, you know, and kind of calling the shots. I mean, I was like taking all the phone calls from the creditors and, you know, and I kind of grew up fast, which wasn't good for me because I had always been the baby of the family. So, you know, I just ran amok with no self-control whatsoever, and which is how I got into the music business. I didn't go to college. I didn't even finish high school. You know, I just like did whatever I saw fit to do. So anyway, having done that, when I finally became interested was when I was living up in Modesto and I had had a car accident and I'd had my kneecap torn off and I had half of my face torn off and, you know, and then I thought, well, okay, fine, I'll quit drinking. But I'm not going to, you know, they kept my pain pills filled for me. So, you know, so I just switched one for another. And then eventually I got into this relationship with this guy. And he said, I had been partying a lot. And it was after about a 3-day run. And I was just, you know, the cops were called. I'm in a blackout because that's also another thing of my drinking. I'm just a blackout drinker. And I guess the cops were called, and it was just really ugly. And so when I woke up the next day, I thought, oh, God, I got to go to work. And this guy that I was living with, Randy, you know, he looked at me and he said, you need help. You're crazy. And I was. And that was how I drank. I just totally, I'm the typical Jekyll and Hyde person that you read about in the book. That was me. That was my drinking path and my using path. So, having said that, I got here. I came back to Visalia. I lived all over the world. I lived in Hong Kong. I lived in Miami. I lived in Atlanta. I lived, you know, in a bunch of different places and did a lot of geographicals. And, you know, when I got out of the music business, you know, I thought, well, I'm not going to be Madonna, and I need a job with, you know, something, 401k or benefits or something. And so that's when I got into retail. And so retail also provided me an avenue to be able to travel. And I did. I just, you know, I moved and went where, you know, where jobs were. And I was pretty good because I was trying to stay sober then. The first time that I got sober, I stayed sober about 5 years. But I was still in the music business and I was still working in bars. And so eventually I picked up and that's when my husband told me I was crazy. He was telling, you know, it's funny because the first time that, you know, I took him to an AA meeting with me, and his synopsis of an AA meeting was, it's just a weak, spineless, emotional wasteland. He was really good with words. And I just believed him, you know, and I thought, hey, that's right, because it was, I was always making somebody else my higher power, and I really didn't have any kind of contact with God, and I really didn't want any. When I got back here in 2011, I think, I came back to Visalia. I was living up in Modesto, and I was sleeping, you know, wherever, and I was on probation, and I was, I had lost my job. I had become totally unemployable. I was living in this garage with this guy in his 85-year-old grandmother's garage, and she didn't care for me much, and so I couldn't use the bathroom in the house. My shower was a spray bottle. It was really attractive, and I had so much fun. You know, I mean, I lost my car, I lost my driver's license, I had lost everything, and I came back here to Visalia. Debbie came up to Modesto and she brought me back here. And I thought, oh my God, this is, what am I going to do? I'm not going to stay here. I had no intentions of staying here. None. And a few things happened, and I did stay. And I really don't know. I really don't know what has happened to me. My sobriety date is not 2011. It's December 12th, 2012. And because I had some trouble. And because that's what I do. I get into trouble. And so anyway, what has happened in my life since I've been back, I'd like to say that it's gotten so great and wonderful and everything's peachy and I love everybody and everything, and that's not true. Because what happens is when you become a habitual relapse person, and especially a woman, you know, you go down. And the first time I got sober, I came back, I became employed, I got a car, I mean, things were boom, boom, boom. Poor Linda, I took her to her first meeting, and she was like, I don't want this either, you know. But since I've been back, you know, now I got back and I was 50, I think, when I got back. And, you know, it's been a trudge, because I had totally lost complete contact with any sort of higher power. And I didn't care about a higher power. And I made it pretty clear that I didn't give up what you believe. It was not going to work for me because it was my belligerent denial, you know. So for me to stand here tonight in front of you and tell you that it has been a trudging road, but wow, there's been a lot of changes in not just my outward life. You know, I got a job, and I opened a savings account and saved money. I've never done that before in my life. And got my driver's license back, and now I'm saving for a car, and my job just went to full time. I mean, all that stuff are definitely gifts from being sober. But the psychic change is so amazing to me, in the fact that I've opened my mind enough to darken the door of a church and enjoy it immensely. And I have people in my life that love me unconditionally and support me in whatever decision I make, people that I can tell anything to, and they do not judge me, no matter what it is. And they let me house sit their animals and stay at their home overnight, you know, while they go on vacation. I mean, these are things. I was not a desirable citizen when I got here. And to have been able to earn that type of trust and that respect from another human being is truly a gift. And it's amazing to me every day that I go to work and people compliment me on my work. I am like a good employee. It's like, oh my God, this stuff is just, it's just really amazing for me, because like I said, when I first got here, I can't even describe to you what my mindset was. And so God's definitely worked in my life when I absolutely denied him. And I'm just really, really grateful to be sober. And I'm really grateful that my brother is sober. And I'm really grateful that my sister is sober. And if you guys just, you know, think about that, it's definitely a family disease. Anyway, that's enough for me. Thank you very much.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I have the distinct pleasure to introduce our Featured speaker, give her a warm Tulare County welcome, Debbie M.
I'm Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's not news to me. Demetra said something that to me is like the most important part of my story. And understand that when I share things tonight about growing up in an alcoholic home, all of that stuff has been dealt with, and I love my mom and dad, and they were the very best parents that they could be, you know, based on their lives and what had happened to them. But my dad was pretty violent, and he was that Jekyll and Hyde, because when my dad was not drinking, he wasn't real violent, but when he would drink, you know, he'd want to get violent with my mom. And so Paul and I lived in a lot of chaos. Demetra didn't come along until years later, and Daddy had kind of stopped drinking then, but Paul and I had some pretty rough times, you know, in growing up in that alcoholic home. And they say that alcoholism is a family disease, and they mean it. Because even if you're not the drinker, my mom didn't even drink it. She wasn't even an alcoholic. She was sicker than any people I've ever known. You know, she was such a good codependent. And, you know, and she never, you know, she just, she, when I could, she endured life. She just endured it. You know, she never liked it. She used to always say, man, if it just wasn't for you kids, and we're like thinking, well, yeah, if it wasn't for us, you know, that makes you feel good when you're like a little kid, you know, if it wasn't for you guys, I'd go live a good life. Well, you know, all of that stuff put me in therapy for years, you know, and I'm a strong advocate for mental health therapy. Because it helped me to face some of the stuff that hung on to me my whole life. I started drinking when I was 15, and it's funny because I was raised in church, and I stopped going to church when I was 15. I met him, and him was the love of my life. And he was on his way to Vietnam. And I wrote him every single day that he was in Vietnam. And him came back, and him was a bad drunk. Bad. And I didn't know that all the stuff that I grew up hating the most, and all the stuff that I always said, when I would see my dad drunk and he would be crying, he would either be angry or he would be sad. And I would say to myself, I am never, ever going to be like that. And I got to tell you, as a fair warning to yourselves, never say never like that. Because I set myself up, you know, I was like a sitting duck. Just, you know, was just waiting for the gun, you know, to come along and knock me off. Because everything that I hated about my dad and his drinking was exactly the kind of drunk I was. It was exactly. 15, I didn't get hooked up with him, but I met another him. And this him I married. And we were married for 4.5 years, and we only drank maybe 2 times a year. We had an employee party, and we'd go to a New Year's Eve party at some friend's house. But every single time I drank, I blacked out first, then I would puke, and then I would pass out every single time I drank. And I didn't know that there was an amount that was a good amount to drink, or I never had an off button. I just didn't have an off button. I just had a more button, you know, and my more button got me in a lot of trouble. And that more button was everything. That more button was about relationships. If you loved me, it wasn't enough. I needed you to really love me. You don't even know how many times I've said that to my husbands. It's like, and I've had 4 of them, so I've had a lot of practice. Husband number 1 went by the wayside along with my child. My son was 2.5 years old, and his dad and I were taking him to the circus. We were still trying to be friends, and we were on our way up to Fresno to take him to the circus. And I pray, I don't know, my son's never said anything to me that he knows or that he remembers anything about this, but I prayed that he didn't, because I never wanted him to feel like I felt when my dad would hurt my mom. But he was griping at me about the people I was hanging out with and what I was doing and who was around my son, and, you know, and in passing, I just said, you know, Charlie, if you keep doing this to me, I'm going to take this baby and leave here. He just reached, you know, he was driving on the freeway. He just reached over, put his hands on my throat, pulled that car over, and he said, I'll kill you first, you know. And he meant it. He never had to hit me. He never had to, because I knew he would. So my decision was, you take our son, and I'll take my Knox. And let me tell you something, you don't give up your child and not take Knox. I've had women tell me, you are the worst piece of shit walking the face of the earth for giving up your child. They've told me that to my face. And don't think that I haven't went to bed crying about it a million times, because I felt that way too. These are all resolved issues now, as I tell you this, know this. But it lets you see how the disease is. I left that marriage, and I was with another him. I was 22, and I was with another him by September. We divorced in April, and by September I had another him. And this was hubby number two, and he was a honky-tonk musician. My kind of life. I loved live music. I have since I was a little kid, because all of our family played music. My mom's brothers and my mom played the guitar, and Paul started playing guitar when he was like 14, and we all sang at home, and I loved music, and I met him, and God, I thought, this is a match made in heaven. And little did I know that he was an alcoholic that was going to, he was going to lead me down some of the most degrading roads that I have ever had to walk as a woman. And he liked to beat me. And I thought it was my fault. I thought that I did something bad or wrong. But it was not my fault. And it took me a lot of years to learn that too. That was through domestic violence training. But I allowed him to do that for 5 years. And I blamed my drinking on him, because I wouldn't have been in the bar if it hadn't been for him. And I blamed it on him. It was all his fault. And it was all of those women. And yeah, you know, and you know, it just went on forever. And then we split up in April. Oh, I never thought about that. We split up in April also. And I stayed drunk from April until July with no him. He wasn't around, and I was still drunk. And that was the worst. That was the worst 6 months. I would come to with my car running. Demetra and I were talking about this. I'd come to with my car running on somebody else's lawn. Not even my house. I just drove there. You know, and the car would be running, and I would, you know, I'd be passed out on the steering wheel, and I would think, oh God, nobody called the cops, you know, and I would take off, and, you know, and I would, you know, drive away, and I would think, oh man, I'm not going to do that again till the next time. I went into Pine the very first time after a night like that, and the worst blackout that I ever had. And there were so many things that happened that night. The drama in my life was like, I was like a blinking light for it. If something bad was going to happen that night, it was going to happen to me. If there was going to be a fight, I was going to be in the middle of it, either starting it or getting the worst end of it. And that particular night, the key broke. I guess I was picking up on some guy, and he could have been a serial killer. I don't know. I didn't even know who he was. I was just picking up on him, and I was going to go home with him, and my key broke off in the ignition. And I was like, I can't go anywhere. Is that a God thing? I couldn't go anywhere. And so they had to come out and unhook the battery, because I couldn't turn the car off. You know, I was like, well, I don't know what to do now. I'm drunk. And, you know, so Doug and Judy, Doug owned the bar, and Doug and Judy were like, well, just come stay at our house. So I went to their house. When I come to the next morning, and I say come to, because I didn't wake up. I hardly ever woke up. But when I came to, I couldn't remember my name. now I have fibromyalgia and I have what's called fibrofog a lot. And I can't remember what I'm doing from 1 minute to the next. But that blackout, I woke up and could not remember my name. And I felt like I had just landed, like I was some kind of an alien. And I looked around the room. I didn't recognize the house. I was like, oh my God, I don't even, where am I? You know, what town is this? And I finally saw a picture of Judy on the wall. And I was like, oh my God, this is Judy. And this is Judy's house. And you're Debbie. And you're in trouble. So I went, there was a telephone book. I never knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about it. I went and opened the phone book, said Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called, and there was a direct hotline that went straight into Pine. And they sent these two squirrely women. One they called Squirrely Carol. The other one was, she had little ponytails all over her head. And they were trying to hug on me. They were loving, hugging. I'm like, oh my God, they're loving me. I don't know, you know. And so they were like, do you want to quit drinking? I was like, well, I want to quit getting drunk. I didn't know about the quitting drinking had to be a part of it, but I definitely wanted to quit getting drunk. And so they were like, okay, so we're gonna take you with us. And I didn't have any clothes or anything. I said, well, you got to take me by my house. I need some things to wear, you know. So they took me by my apartment, and I packed a suitcase. I couldn't even tell you what I took into Pine, but I will tell you that the magic happened to me while I was in Pine, and it happened in 28 days. Those 28 days were, I met people, you know, they say that we were people that would normally not mix. And I met a man, his name was Kenny Hogan, bless his heart, he's deceased now, but I loved Kenny so much. He was a murderer, and he taught me about God, and he said, who do you think God loves more? I'm waiting for the trick question. He goes, the man on the floor with the gun to his head, or the man holding the gun? And I had to think about that, because I was like, well, I guess he loves them both the same, you know, because I'm real judgmental. I'm real judgmental, you know. I'm like, oh, I don't do that. She does that one. I don't do that. But, you know, I mean, that's how my mind works. But Kenny taught me about God. He taught me that night when he told me that. I used to go there. I'd get off work, and then I would go to Pine so I could have a cup of coffee before they locked the doors at 11 o'clock, because I felt safe there. And I went to 3 or 4 meetings a day. I stayed sober for 23 years. Now, I have to tell you that in those 23 years, a lot of things happened. There was a lot of life that went under the bridge in 23 years. But those 23 years, I had a life that I didn't understand would be ripped away from me the minute that I picked up that drink, but it was. And I couldn't just call it back. I wanted to call it back. I wanted it to be like it never happened, but it did happen. And it took 5 years of that relapse to make it back to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took 5 long, hard years. And those 5 years of drinking were not fun. They were not fun. I have some friends here in town. This one gal in particular, I've known them. They were Hymns, the first Hymns brothers, sisters. And I drank a lot with Maggie, because Maggie and I, we didn't even pretend to drink like ladies. We would go and buy the bottles of booze that we both wanted, and we didn't even bother pouring them in a glass. We just drank right out of the bottle as fast as we could guzzle it down. And that's how I drink. It isn't for fun. It isn't so I can relax. It isn't so I can have a good time. It's because I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. And alcohol, my liver has a way of detoxifying that booze so fast that I can drink and drink more than most people would die from alcohol poisoning. But I can just keep pouring it down. And I did that. During that relapse, I met another him. Oh, I left a him out in there. I left a him out in there that was husband number three, and he was in AA. He was sober, and he, you know, hey, I, all was good. And we were together for 3 years, but we were only married for 6 months. And it turns out he was a pedophile. My friend Doc used to tell me, Debbie, your picker is broken. The next time you get ready to find one, would you let me go and check them out? Because I come home with some doozies, let me tell you. And it hasn't gotten much better. So after that divorce, and then I decided, man, they're all bad. They're all bad. And then I got involved with somebody else in AA, and it got worse. It got worse. People in AA are sober, and they can do stuff. They can do stuff that you never even dreamed of. I was like, oh my gosh, this has never happened to me in my life. What's going on now, you know? Well, so I had to walk through some hard things, and I lost a business, and I lost my reputation, I lost my career, and all of that because I'm out looking for him all the time, right? And I think I'm not complete without him. And I've been that way since I was 7 years old. 7 years old, I've always had a boyfriend. And now I'm 62 and I don't give a shit. Please don't let me ever want one again. But it's just hard on me. So in this relapse, I meet him again. I meet him in that relapse. And, you know, and I met him. I met him, for crying out loud. He was the husband that beat me. He was his best friend. And I met him in the same bar that I met Chris in. So there's Dennis. Dennis is drunk. And, you know, and I'm drunk. And the next thing I know, we're going to Las Vegas getting married. You know, I'm like, well, yeah, that's what I do. Because I don't want to, like, live in sin or nothing. I vote living in sin now. If you want to do that, I vote for it. Because, man, getting unmarried is a big deal. You can get married any day, but that unmarrying stuff is hard. It's really hard. So, I'm with him, and the first thing that he tells me, Dennis really saved my life. He came to Arkansas and brought me back to California. You know, I lost my home. I fell. I'll regress a little bit. I fell. I destroyed 4 vertebrae in my back. I couldn't walk. You know, I was on a walker and go to the stores, have to ride in those little scooter things. And I'm not good at that. And I'm really not good at asking anybody for help. I'm really not good at that. I believe they call that pride. Anyway, that's one of my worst. Anyway, Dennis talked to me the whole time I was gone. I was in Arkansas for 6 months, and I thought I was going to die. Because after I hurt my back, and I had gone to the doctor, and had all of these, they put me on all these different medications, and the next thing you know, I'm strung out on pills. In addition to my drinking. So while I'm in Arkansas, and they've got me set up for surgery. They had the back surgery. They said, well, you have to have somebody take care of you for 6 weeks. I'm like, I don't even know anybody in Arkansas. I don't know of anybody who would care if I was hurting, or I don't even know a soul. You know, I kind of said hi to the neighbors and waved at them, and that was about it. So I told Dennis, please come and get me. Please come and get me. And so he did. He found a way. It was a God deal. And he came back and we moved me back to California. I kissed the ground when we crossed over the state line. You couldn't budge me out of the state. I don't care if we go completely dry. Man, I'll learn how to do showers a different way, but I ain't staying in California. So Dennis and I are together, and he still wants to go out drinking and stuff and doing what we did that caused us to have so much fun, you know. And, you know, the one thing that I remember the most about mine and his relationship in the bars was we went to the Stag. He liked to do karaoke. We went to the Stag one night, one afternoon, and I was on a Sunday, and I drank all these blue drinks called Adioses, and they mean that. They mean it. It was 6 shots all clear liquors, and I drank, you're only supposed to have two, I drank three. So I don't, you know, all I can remember was we went to eat dinner at that little Mexican restaurant next to it, and, you know, and I walked into the restaurant, I was able to do that. I sat down at the table, and the minute that it got warm, I don't know what happened, but man, I just went, you know, right with my face, right down into the plate. And so the waiter says, he's over there, and he's like, oh, honey, let me help clean you up. Oh, and I'm so ashamed. I'm so ashamed, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm so ashamed. I'm begging you, please forgive me. God, this is awful. I just felt bad, and Dennis helped. They both practically drugged me out of the restaurant and put me in the car. And so when I get back from Arkansas, and, you know, and I haven't had anything to drink and haven't had no pills because I did the whole flush thing, you know, like almost kill myself because I was stupid, I would not advise anybody to do that. You know, you do not take... I took 8 different pills 3 times a day. So that's a lot of pills. And I just flushed everything because I thought, well, I want to be sober again. But except that I almost killed myself doing that. So it was not a good way to do it, but the doctor, you know, the doctor was real mad at me, wanted to put me back on some other pain medication there in the hospital. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. You better find a different way because I'm not doing that, you know. I already puked for 4 days. I'm not going to do that. So, you know, I stayed at this lady's board and care home for 30 days before Dennis got there, and it was for handicapped people, and she had this, you know, like the little ramp with, you know, with handrails on it, and I taught myself how to walk again. And they laughed at me. The girls that worked there, they said, you look terrible, but, you know, I was taking little baby steps because my back wouldn't hold me, you know, so I did it, and I'd like to take credit for that, but the deal is like there is such a powerful power greater than me, more than I could say, gosh, I willed it, and I wanted to be able to walk again, and I wanted to be able to be quasi-normal in the physical sense, but... He came and got me, brought me back, and he wanted to go dancing and do all the drinking that we used to do. And he said, you're no fun anymore. I liked you better drunk. He said it several times, you know, and I was like, that kind of hurt my feelings, you know, because I'm like thinking, gosh, sobriety to me is like everything, has to be everything. If it's not everything, it's not going to be anything. And, you know, and I'd drag him to meetings with me here and there, speakers meetings, and, you know, and he would say, yeah, that's a good, those people really need that shit. I'm like, Dennis, that's me. I am those people. I really need that shit. So, I mean, that was about the only way that, you know, that I could pair it up to him. And, you know, we split up in September of last year, and we were together for 9 years, and Michelle was saying, I was talking to her earlier, and she was like, you know, it's really hard, and, you know, the truth of the matter is that there are lots of things harder, you know, losing somebody that you love is much harder than losing a drinking buddy. And Dennis and I were good drinking buddies. When I was a drunk, I was right there with him, and I could hold my own. But he liked that because, you know, I could drive and I could do all that stuff, you know. But and dance, he loved that, you know. And that wasn't who I could be sober. And so we split up, and I don't miss that. Nitpicking that people do when they're angry at each other, but nobody comes out and says they're angry. You know, you just do the little tiny digs here and there, and it's so wearing. It really wore on me, and I'm sure it wore on him. She's probably glad to get rid of my ass. But you know, when I left him, we don't hate each other. We're not. You know, we had that big fight that night, and then I had to go back. See, most people don't have to do this, but I'm such a wussy, man. I screamed awful things to him and pushed him out the door, you know, because he was like screaming at Demetra and yelling at her, and I can't have that, you know. You don't need me. I can't do that. So, I'm pushing him out the door at his house, and you get out of here and don't come back of his house. And so, about 3 days later, 3 or 4 days later, I had to go make amends to him because, you know, it says make direct amends to such people whenever it's possible. And, you know, the deal with me is that I don't sleep well. When I've been mean to somebody, when I've hurt somebody, I don't sleep good. I don't pray good. Me and God have this deal that I pray only for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. I pray for other people all the time, but I never ask God for one thing for me. I don't do it. Not because I think I'm so good, but it's just that I don't know what I need. I don't know what I need. But now if somebody says, you know, I'm sick, you know, pray for me. Yeah, I pray for lots of people a lot of times. But I don't pray for me. But whenever I am, like, out of the sunlight of the Spirit, when I'm being all shitty to another human being, even if it's somebody on the freeway that I don't like and I'm flipping them off, I don't chase them down to make an amends, but I tell God, I really don't mean, you know, I'm really sorry I did that, you know. But except for that gal that almost rear-ended me the other night, she scared the shit out of me. Whew, came really close. But I went to Dennis and I told him just my side of the street. I didn't tell him, you know, how worthless I thought all that stuff was that he did or said. I just cleaned up my side of the street. And, you know, and I walked away from there with my head held high and my dignity intact. Because that's what the program provides for me. Especially if you're an alcoholic woman. Men can get away with a lot more, you know. And society will look at men and go, oh, you guys are just tough guys, huh? And they look at women, and women do the same thing, and they're like, you're a bitch. You need to take care of yourself. But, you know, it's kind of just the way things are. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that the way things that I want don't always come to me. They don't come to me that way. So I've weaned myself from setting goals like, oh, if I don't get that, I'm just going to be heartsick. I don't do that. And then something really nice happens, and it's like a pleasant surprise. You know, because I don't put myself out there in something that I have to have that's going to make me miserable if I don't get it, you know. But if I allow God to bring to me what He wants me to have, I always have food on the table. The rent's paid every month. The bills get paid. We get to go shopping once in a while and splurge. There's like little things that are like really good stuff. This time around in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have changed. I would say probably I attribute it to my age more than anything, is that the things that are important to me is not stuff. The things that are important to me is, like tonight when Demetra said that she is amazing for Paul and Demetra and I to be in this room together sober, all three of us. Because the family dynamics were so torn and shredded in our family that no human power could have healed that. So the things that are important to me now are the things that I know that are God put. You know, they're not something I created or not something I helped make happen. It's like, it's just things that they're gifts, you know, gifts that were given. Demetra and I moved in this little apartment. There is a rose garden right in front of our apartment. Rose garden. And I love that rose garden. It's like, and I have allergies really bad, and I know I'm not supposed to be out there sniffing, but I can't help it. I have to go smell those roses. It's like the best things in life are the free things, you know. I get to spend time, quality time with my friends. My best friend from the coast, her mom just died, and I got to go and spend time with her, and all of her siblings got together, and they were all there. We haven't seen each other in years and years, and I can do that because I'm sober. I can show up. I can be supportive, you know, and not they don't have to worry about me and what's going to happen with me because of my drinking, because they went through it with my drinking. They know what I'm like, you know, to be around. Judy was one of my biggest enablers in the world when I was a drunk in my younger years. We all drank together in Porterville, and Chris would beat me up. I would leave him, go to her house, and live with her and her two boys. And we would go out partying and then, you know, go to work the next day and act like we hadn't been out till 2 or 3 in the morning. And, you know, and when you're young, you can do that. When you get old, this last relapse, when I was 50 years old when I relapsed, you can't do that. It would take 3 days. 3 days just to physically get well enough to get back around where I could, like, shower and walk and talk. Yeah. 3 days, that's a long time, you know? So, God's grace is sufficient for me today. It meets all of my needs. It gives me the desires of my heart, not something that anybody else can give me. I don't look to anybody else to meet those empty places in me anymore. And I've always had big empty places. I've always had a big empty place where other people had to make it okay. You know, if they would let me run with that group, I would have made it. If I could get that job, I would have made it. And I got those jobs. I had those things. I ran with those people. And I still had those big empty spaces inside of me. And even though I was raised in church, you know, when I was in eighth grade, the minister's son from my church gave me a picture, his senior picture, and on the back of it, I still have his picture, on the back of it, he wrote, "You are your own worst enemy." How did he know that? I was in the eighth grade. How did he know that? And he said, "If you could unload that large chip." How did he know that? I didn't know that. All I knew was that I was surviving. Everything that I did in my life was about surviving. And it wasn't about a good surviving. It was about scrapping and fighting. And, you know, when I was married to that guy that was abusive, I do not put all the blame on him, because, you know, he would go out with some woman and I'd go sleep with his best friend. Yeah, I mean, I'll show you, you know. It was a horrible existence. And he has no more the blame. And every one of my relationships, who's the only constant? I'm the only one that was in all of them. The rest of those guys come and went. But I was constant in each one of those relationships. And part of where I'm growing today is that even with Demetra and I living in the same house, we have to learn how to get along with each other. How not to demand. How not to expect. You know, how to... I'm real bad about expecting things from people. You know, I do stuff, I expect other people to do things. It's like, oh no, that sets that person up to fail, and it sets me up, you know, to be disappointed. You know, so it's like learning how to do that, learning how to talk about it. You know, communication is key. And it's important to me to be able to come tonight to be of service, just to share with you that the best thing in my life is being sober. That's the best thing I got going. I have love from other people. That's a good deal. I have many people that I love. That's a real good deal. And my happiness isn't contingent on any of the outward stuff. My happiness is an inside job, and I choose it. I choose it no matter what's coming down the pike, no matter, I don't like my health. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, that makes it difficult for me, but I'm happy. I don't, you know, I can't blame it. I went to the doctor this morning and he's checking on my sinuses, you know, and he's got the lights and, you know, little bells and whistles, and he touches my neck and my shoulder here, and he said, What's wrong with you? He didn't have time. I should have told him that. But, you know, I have fibro. And he said, you're like a rock. And I said, I know this. I know this. You know, but for the doctor to say, what's wrong with you? I'm like, oh, man, you know, these guys, they don't know much. But that pretty much is like my life. It's like, okay, the things that are not okay with me are just okay. I don't have to fight them. I don't have to hate them. I don't have to, you know, they don't run my life. My alcoholism doesn't run my life. I can walk down the wine aisle. I don't care. I'd rather walk down the cookie aisle, but if I have to go down that aisle to get to where I want to go, I'm cool with it. It's not a big deal. But some people can't. It doesn't make my way better. It just means that some people can't. You know, they say if you hang around a barbershop long enough, you get a haircut. And I suppose that's probably what I did. I was hanging around a lot of barbershops when I picked up drinking, you know, because I had lots of friends who drank. And I hung around long enough, and I did everything that the book says. You know, I was reading about Ebby the other day. You know, Ebby was the constant relapser, and he was Bill Wilson's sponsor. And he's part of the reason that Bill wrote some of those steps. And the greatest step that he wrote, he was mad at his sponsor, and he was mad at him for relapsing, and he said it was because he had too many resentments. And that's why Ebby kept getting drunk. And that, you know, that was part of why the steps are written like they were, was because he was mad at Ebby. And I'm like, wow, how about that, man? But the deal is that resentment is the number one offender. And so if I look at any of you tonight in the eyes and I told you one thing that was the direct cause of my drinking, it was resentment. Because I had a lot of it, and I carried it for years. And I was so bitter and so angry that I can taste it on the back of my tongue. I don't know if you've ever been that bitter, but it's not a good place to be. But not dealing with it, it dealt with me. And it was easier to drink than it was to face who I had become through that bitterness and through that anger. So the good news is, those of you that have never relapsed, you don't have to relapse. Those of you that might have relapsed and you're feeling bad about it, don't. Because I'm in a better spiritual place now than in those 23 years that I had before. I can't tell you why. I have to just say it's because of God's grace, because it has been freely given to me this time. Not something that I had to scratch out and make work or do something to make it happen. It's just been because of the grace. You know, I kind of think that that's kind of the way Bill got sober. It was by grace, and he talks about it. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm honored that you asked me to come and share tonight, Rick. And I am really honored that I got to share with Demetra and her speaking to be the opening speaker, because it does my heart really good medicine. Thank you for letting me share. And that's all I have. Thank you, Rick.